Welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SAFM.
Thank you very much for that news update. There'll be more news at 7 o'clock. Welcome to the special Women's Day edition of the SAFM Market Update. A pleasant and happy Women's Day to all those that celebrated yesterday. Back in 1956, exactly 70 years ago, more than 20,000 women marched on the Union buildings after delivering their petitions against the pass laws. They stood together in silence for 30 minutes and fundamentally changed the course of history for this country. I'm Jimmy Moyaha. This is the SAFM Market Update. Let's get you up to date. Coming up on the show today, we have a special edition honoring the women of South Africa and their contributions towards the South African economy. Given that today is a public holiday, as always, markets locally would have been closed, so there will be no market update conversation. However, we will be having a conversation with Jeannie Faree of Kearney Africa to take a look at the questions that businesses need to be asking around empowerment and inclusivity, especially in the day and age that we find ourselves in today. Then we have a conversation with the Institute of Directors of South Africa's Chief Executive Officer, Professor Parmi Natasan, to take a look at the board readiness and preparedness that needs to go into leadership positions, especially if we are to better improve the leadership conversations around representation as well at the highest levels. We have a conversation with the founder and CEO of Femio, Mona Lisa Zwambila, about the empowerment of women and the support systems that can be put in place if we hope to ensure that financial inclusion and gender equality result in meaningful change. And we wrap up the show with an inspirational story by the founder and chief executive officer of SRS Aviation, Sibongile Sambo. She shares her entrepreneurial journey as a female entrepreneur in a male-dominated industry like the aviation industry. We look forward to that and all these other conversations as we reflect on the holiday that is Women's Day.
You are listening to Jimmy Moyaha on SAFM.
South African businesses play a very important role in ensuring that we achieve greater inclusivity in the workplace. We're going to be unpacking this in a bit more detail, especially where it relates to some of the decisions and questions that need to be made in South African businesses. I'm joined on the line by management consultant and manager at Kearney Africa, Jeannie Faree, to take a look at this and see what to make of it. Jeannie, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Where do South African businesses sit in terms of responsibility towards achieving inclusivity and empowering women?
Thanks for having me, Jimmy. And I think it's such an interesting question to unpack because South African businesses, of course, are fundamentally responsible for driving our economy. And women, as 50% of the population, play a large role in this. So if we think about how we want to drive economic growth, that inclusion question and making sure that it's representative is fundamentally part of what a company should be looking at.
Jeannie, companies often have empowerment directives across racial lines, and now most recently we've seen the inclusion of these objectives across gender-based lines. Is that enough from a business perspective to ensure that we're having more representation within businesses, or is it that something else can be done and potentially should be done by businesses to ensure that they do more?
And look, I think targets are always one part of the story, and it's definitely a step in the right direction to also start thinking about meaningful targets that can be driven within organizations themselves, of course, relevant to the sector. Because what we've seen, and I think what we also saw in our recent study, is that while at board level, we're seeing almost 40% representation by women in South Africa, which is fantastic. It's absolute progress. We're still lagging behind when it comes to that senior leadership, executive level female representation. And that's ultimately who steers the ship. So having some targets in place for that can definitely help hold leadership accountable. But beyond that, it also comes down to how it's implemented. And at business level, having the CEO, having the leadership team actually set stretch targets. And it's something that I think we've seen in a number of organizations, that although they are targets below board level, they're often not truly a stretch. So having that in mind, putting it into practice, can definitely move us from conversation to actual meaningful progress.
Jeannie, you touched on the fact that 50% of the population are women, and I suppose that speaks to things around the workplace pipeline, things around the responsibilities that now are assigned to the individuals that sit in various roles, but also it speaks to the talent pool. Clearly, it means that the talent pool, especially when we're hiring the best suited candidates for the job, now needs to look at what it is that everybody brings to the table and not necessarily take a biased view based on some of those quotas and objectives that we spoke about earlier.
And you're 100% right, Jimmy. I think this is always a question about who's best for the job. And we should move away from thinking about a quota, rather think about a target. A target takes the emotion out of it. You would have a revenue target, you'd be absolutely fine with it. It's about how do we meet it in a meaningful way. And I think that's where it also comes down to the pipeline conversation. Because very true, if we're talking roughly half the population and we also look at how women actually perform in academic settings, there we often actually see more tertiary graduates. We see women graduating with more advanced degrees. And yet, when it comes into translating that into the workforce, that's often where it falls short, which leaves us with a sad reality that society appears to be better at educating women than actually trusting them with authority.
If you're just tuning in, we're in conversation with Jeannie Faree of Kearney Africa to take a look at the responsibilities that businesses in South Africa hold towards ensuring that empowerment and inclusion are achieved where it relates to women in businesses. Jeannie, I want to take a look at something you touched on around the ability to educate women and the talent pool that that then creates. We're also seeing that regardless of whether we're looking at men or women, we're seeing that in the South African context, a lack of opportunity has forced qualified professionals to perhaps seek employment outside the borders of South Africa. And I want to take a look at that as something that could potentially be dangerous towards the South African economy, losing that kind of talent, whether we're looking at losing that level of talent, regardless of whether it is male or female, especially female, where there is an underrepresentation already. We can ill afford to lose the little talent we already have.
And there I fully agree. I think South Africa is at a point where we absolutely need to be targeted in how we drive growth. We've been in a depressed growth situation for far too long. And a big part of turning that around is skills. We have many skilled people. I think we have a lot of very rare skills as well. But we need to be strategic in how we actually drive the economic growth to also retain those individuals. Because if you do have a highly skilled person, it's only natural that they're going to look for the best possible opportunity to add value. So it's a bit of a chicken and an egg situation. But to your point, I think it's fundamentally important that South Africa looks at how we create sustainable employment that's also going to keep our top candidates here, keep them excited, and want them to be part of what can be a phenomenal growth story.
Jeannie, many women have said in businesses or in companies that they are a part of that they often feel invisible, they feel unseen where it relates to their contributions. And I know that for some, this would be considered a stereotype, but for some women, this is a stark reality that they're still faced with and confronted with, depending on the sectors that they operate in. How do we address that? How do we change that perception, whether it's in the companies themselves or just generally as a South African society?
And that's such a good question because it's not something that's easy to solve. I think a lot of it comes down to conversation and both men and women being aware of perhaps a unintended bias, something that they don't even know they have, or something that is preventing them from making someone else feel truly seen. Because I'm sure many men also feel this way. I don't think it's women alone, but to your point, often it can be biased that way. And especially in male-dominated industries, I work in the energy industry. I was in engineering for almost 10 years before starting at Kearney as a management consultant. I was often the only woman in the room. And it was never that the door was closed to me. It was more around how hard you had to work for the trust when you are the other. Which I don't think is unfair. I think people are naturally risk averse, but having the conversations and doing that as you move through the employment pipeline is important, because then everyone on both sides of the gender, and this is not a sides conversation, we're all together in this, understand the small things they can do to ultimately pull in everyone and then work together to be far more efficient and effective.
Jeannie, before I let you go, can we take a look at the African continent in a broader context? South Africa has some of its own challenges around how it is that we're addressing the inclusion conversation, but broadly on the African continent, South Africa sits in a unique position in that it is potentially the most industrialized economy on the continent, and therefore perhaps some of the other African countries look towards South Africa for leadership and almost to set an example in how it is that we move the continent forward as a whole. What then should be the focal point of businesses in South Africa if we are to look at achieving greater inclusion and look at recognizing women for the valuable contributions they give towards not just businesses, but the economy as a whole?
And here I think it ultimately comes down to how you move from that board level with visibility, because this is something that we are seeing progress in, and it's something to celebrate today on Women's Day. But making the same impact in leadership, those individuals that are actually making the decision on Monday morning around where the money gets spent, if we can show the same incredible increase there and drive that level of inclusion, I think that will set the example that's needed for the rest of the continent.
Speaking of examples, Jeannie, what would be a good example for the next generation to look forward to take away from the changes that are being made in businesses? Where do we leave these good examples? Because it's one thing to do this and have these changes effective in the now, but it's more important to have it translate into a generational change that fundamentally shifts how things are done going forward.
And it's such an interesting question, because I think what we do now will fundamentally set that example for the future and make that shift easier. Ideally, we get to a point where we stop having these conversations because gender parity is the norm. And the more you see women in leadership, you see women that role model, you see women throughout the ranks that you can aspire to be. And this is for both men and women, because men can also have female role models. The more that becomes the norm, the more it gets entrenched in how we work.
Making inclusivity conversations the norm such that we don't have to have them as special conversations anymore, but that they are an ingrained part of who it is that we are. That is the ultimate goal we should all be striving for. That's where we're going to leave the conversation for now. Thanks so much to Kearney Africa's Jeannie Faree for joining us to take a look at achieving inclusivity in businesses and what it is that businesses hold as a responsibility towards empowerment.
In case you're on the highway, driving to your first big maize delivery, and something mysterious happens. You stop at the garage to scope the damage. You realize the fuel system is kinda dear macaw. You panic. But then you take a deep breath. Because you know Hino Care Gap Cover is there to cover anything outside the standard 6-year warranty. From steering columns to ABS control modules, it's the unseen essential in your business. Speak to your Hino dealer. T's and C's apply. Hino. All the way.
Did you know that South Africa has one of the highest crypto adoption rates in the world? Fact. With that comes massive innovation and new opportunities. Stablecoins are the new buzzword in the industry. These are crypto versions of the Rand, the Euro, and the US dollar. But what's coming is even more exciting. Being able to borrow against your crypto and buying tokenized real-world assets such as stocks, wine, football teams, and real estate. Join me, Kieran Ryan, on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast each week to stay on top of what's happening in the fascinating world of crypto.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As part of celebrating and honoring the women of South Africa, we're going to be taking a look at how it is that we can better improve the preparedness of women in boardrooms as well as in board-related situations. This is a critical aspect of where it is that we need to see representation, and it is important that where we have that opportunity, that we have the most prepared candidates possible to step into these particular roles. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with the Institute of Directors in South Africa. I'm joined on the line by the Chief Executive Officer of the Institute, Padmi Natasan, to take a look at this and see what to make of it. Padmi, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. How important is it to understand board readiness, understand boardroom dynamics, especially as women in largely what has been male-dominated spaces?
Yes, thank you, Jimmy, and thank you for inviting me. I think it's critically important for both men and women to be ready to take a board position, to understand what the role requires. You know, what I often find is that there's a misconception out there that being appointed as a non-executive director seems like a cushy job, for want of a better word, in that people think, well, it's just four meetings a year and I get this big fee. But what people don't see is that becoming a director on a board of an organization comes with legal duties and responsibilities. It comes with risk to yourself personally. And it also comes with potential legal liability down the line if you don't fulfill those duties. And so I think it's exceptionally important. You know, board positions are positions of accountability. They're positions of service. They're not necessarily positions of recognition or of stature. And I think that's really one misconception. You know, would you take a job or a role as a teacher or a medical doctor if you weren't trained and educated and experienced in doing that job? Probably not. But for some or other reason, for directorship, people tend to want to put up their hands very quickly without understanding the role, their readiness to serve that role. And really, you know, we talk about ethics and effectiveness. Now, effectiveness is, do you have the competence to serve? And with that competence comes confidence. So you put your hand up when you feel confident enough that you have the skills and experience to be able to do the job well. Alongside that, we talk about ethics, and I'm going to go as far as to say, you know, if individuals are applying for roles that they're not ready for, that's almost an ethics question, because you should be really assured that you have the necessary competencies in order to serve.
Padmi, when we look at readiness, a part of that readiness includes adequate and relevant training. We often don't think about board positions as positions that require training or that have the need for having individuals be trained up on certain issues. And I want to look at what dangers that poses if we forget about the training aspect of it, because readiness goes beyond just saying the person or the candidate has the correct qualifications, but there's a level of experience, a level of preparedness that comes with it.
Yes, I agree. You know, there are so many things, and we actually at the Institute of Directors a number of years ago developed what we call a director competency framework, which lists the competencies that are required in order for someone to be able to serve effectively as a director. And within there, there's technical competencies on the one hand. So what are the things you need to know, the technical things, your legal duties in the Companies Act? How to interpret and understand a set of financial statements, even if you are not a financial person. You know, the difference between solvency and liquidity. There's all these technical things, integrated reporting. Now we're moving towards sustainability reporting. There's all these technical things that you have to have been. And these are not necessarily things that are covered in education or in degrees. A lot of it gets covered in your experience as you work your way up through the ranks of an organization. And that's why that experience portion of it is so critical. So you want knowledge, skills, and experience in order to serve at the level of non-executive directorship. And it's a different level to being in an executive position. So I would have people coming to me to say, I'm an excellent lawyer, I'm an excellent accountant, I'm an excellent company secretary, I'm ready now to be a non-executive. And I'd say, but that's a completely different competency and skill that you need to have. So what makes you think you're ready? And it's really about people understanding that when you're an executive, you have a whole lot of information upon which you base your decisions and your actions. When you're a non-executive, there's an asymmetry of information. So you're getting information from the executives, let's say once a quarter in a board meeting. You need to be able to interpret, analyze, read, question, ask yourself, does this whole picture fit together? Does this all make sense? How can we be performing so well, but the rest of the organizations in our industry aren't? Why aren't we experiencing the challenges that other organizations are experiencing? I often tell people, when you read a board pack, it's not always what's on the page that you need to be worried about. It's actually what's not on the page. And that's where the skill of asking the right questions comes into place. Now, the risk, which was part of your question, is imagine an organization which has such a massive role in society, right? Organizations employ people. They provide services. They contribute to our fiscus through taxes and all of these things. And imagine if that organization doesn't survive and thrive because people are being appointed onto boards who don't have the skill to understand what their role is. Because essentially that board of directors is the one that drives the strategy of the organization and oversees the performance of that organization. So it's absolutely risky from both an organizational perspective and an individual's perspective to take the role without understanding what the role entails. And you may have younger, you know, less experienced directors who need to start with the basics of understanding their legal duties, fiduciary duties, etc., in terms of the legislation, understanding strategic oversight versus operational management, understanding risks and opportunities in the industry. There are all these things that can be learned. There are also other things that when you join the board that you need to do in terms of a thorough induction to understand this organization, its industry, how it operates, how you can add value very quickly. And then apart from that, even experienced directors, ones who have been around the boardroom table for a long time, they also need to do continuous professional development because, as we know, the world is changing all the time. You know, we've just released King 5 last year in October. So if people went on training 2 years ago, they were being trained on King 4 principles, and now King 5 is in place. So it just means you need to be keeping up to date all the time, every year, in order to really treat this as a profession as it deserves to be treated.
If you're just joining us, we're in conversation with the Chief Executive Officer of the Institute of Directors in South Africa, Professor Padmi Natasan, taking a look at board readiness, board preparedness in the context of empowerment and how it is that we achieve that. Pardon me, this year we're celebrating the theme of empowered women empower nations, and that's quite telling of where it is that we need to be focusing our efforts if we are to achieve greater inclusion and greater growth from a nation, from a national perspective. I want to get your thoughts on perhaps how it is that we start to think about the practical aspects of ensuring that we are adequately prepared for these conversations and for these positions. We've seen a lot of companies do quite a good job at promotion, internal empowerment, and building a stronger pipeline of internal candidates within their own respective organizations. That's resulted in us almost seeing a very different kind of boardroom environment that we have in 2026, perhaps to what we may have had 10, 20 years ago. How is it that companies themselves are now starting to leverage off of being prepared or better preparing their own internal candidates for board positions? And what could we learn from that as perhaps individuals that sit outside these companies?
Yeah, so you mentioned, you know, the sort of trends that we've seen over the years. And I have to say, South Africa is actually up there if you look at the percentage of females on boards worldwide. South Africa is not doing that badly. And I think it's got to do with our history of, you know, inequality and our history of legislation that requires employment equity and broad-based economic empowerment, etc., that possibly pushes us up there. But having said that, if we, let's say, in around the 20% of women serving on boards, we have to understand that that's quite a lot lower than, for example, we know that research shows that women control majority of consumer spending. Women are forming a larger and larger portion of the educated workforce. So, you know, in terms of the growth of women in business, we should see a growth of women on boards to over that 20% sort of mark. And yes, as you say, many organizations have plans in place in terms of the pipeline they're building, which is actually really encouraging. And I do think we're moving in the right direction. And I've seen progress over the years. But I think there's a couple of more things that organizations can be doing. I think, you know, recruitment is one where I think there's possibility to look beyond the usual networks. And especially when people are recruiting for non-executive director positions, which are almost, you know, not people employed in the organization. So they're almost coming in sort of independent and fresh into the organization to serve on that board. And you often find that organizations may within their networks of their current board members say, does anyone know someone we could approach to fill this vacancy? Whereas I think they could widen the pool a little bit and consider, far wider candidates in that search. The other thing is to invest early in the development of individuals. And, for example, we have at the Institute of Directors two director designations, and the entry designation is called Certified Director. And we actually do pick up that some organizations are already encouraging and sponsoring the women in their organizations to come and do the program and write the exams and get certified. And that's almost a signal to the market that these individuals have been tested and vetted and that they have the necessary skills and competencies in order to serve. So I think that's important. And then even formal mentorship and coaching, et cetera, within organizations, which I think does happen, possibly giving people exposure to governance discussions before they've even been appointed to the boards, inviting some of the maybe senior management into observe board committee meetings, for example, where typically an executive would be at the meeting presenting information. Perhaps the senior manager who reports to the executive could also be invited as an observer into the meeting, just so that they can start getting exposed to how the boardroom works. And then succession planning is another important thing for organizations. So to really be thinking, and it's not always a comfortable topic, but to really be thinking about who is next in the pipeline? What can we do to expose them early, to give them the necessary training, guidance, coaching, etc., to get them board ready so that when a vacancy does arise, there's nothing then standing in their way. They're ready to take on that opportunity.
Pardon me, you mentioned that for board positions in particular and for boardroom conversations in particular, being ready and understanding what it is that you're ready for becomes that much more important. And I want to get your thoughts on how it is that someone out there that isn't perhaps on a board at this stage, that is looking at their career path and thinking perhaps a board position is the next step for my career development, how do we navigate that, particularly as a woman that might not have the relationships in the particular company, or that might not have the experience that we discussed earlier, or that might not have any indication or any idea of how to go about being board ready and preparing themselves for that? Where would you say is the best starting point in that conversation?
I think that's a bit of a difficult conversation, because I do think there's baby steps and sort of levels which people need to build up within an organization in order to sort of get there. I do think as individuals are firstly excellent at the jobs that they're doing currently, they will get more and more exposure to elevate that and to gain more experience in the organization and more exposure to these things. There's also opportunities to book and attend training, and we sort of train thousands of people every year as an example. And one of the training courses that we've done in the past is a board simulation. So we actually simulate a board meeting and issue board packs to the delegates, and they actually run through a simulated board meeting as if they were the board of directors. And that's always an exciting and interesting one for individuals who have never perhaps been inside a boardroom. The other very important part that I think people perhaps neglect at times, and it's one of the main reasons people join us as a member, one of the main benefits that our members state they appreciate, is the ability to network with the right level of people. So if individuals are serious about becoming a non-executive director in the future, or even an executive director in the future, are they exposing themselves to the right type of networks? Who are going to be able to guide them, advise them, even if it's not personal one-on-one networks, it could just be attending things like roundtables and webinars, etc. I hosted one this morning, in fact, for Women's Month on really women reaching, the helm within organizations and their journey and how they got there and the struggles and how they managed to overcome them. And I think all of these things just adds to strengthening the ability of women to be successful in their roles and to grow within their organizations to higher levels.
strengthening the readiness of ensuring that we achieve a better preparedness and corporate readiness, especially where it relates to boardroom and board conversations. It is imperative that we make sure that in all of the conversations that we're having around empowerment, that we are thinking about it at all different levels. We'll have to leave the conversation on that note. Institute of Directors in South Africa, Chief Executive Officer Prof. Padmanathan, joining us to take a look at how it is that we better improve board readiness and board preparedness.
Did you know? Recent rain does not always mean your soil is at field water capacity. Omnia can help determine plant available water, giving producers a view of their planting risk profile. It's one more way Soil Insight helps reduce production risk. Omnia Nutriology. Better farming starts with understanding your soil.
I'm Nobukhanya Mtambo, the host of MoneyWeb's small business podcast, Mzansi Business, built around the real voices of South African entrepreneurs. This is where the conversation becomes real, where business owners share what it actually takes to build, not just succeed, but survive. We shine the spotlight on local businesses, their challenges, growth, and what it takes to succeed. Each episode becomes a moment of truth, a decision point, a lesson, a turning point in a real business journey.
The podcast delivers deep, honest conversations with entrepreneurs navigating real decisions. This is where trust is built.
Money, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Empowerment means very little without financial inclusion, and that's what we're going to be looking into in a bit more detail as we continue our Women's Day special. We're going to be taking a look at the importance of financial inclusion, wealth creation, and collective spending, especially where it relates to women and women-owned businesses. I'm joined on the line by serial entrepreneur and founder at Femio, Mona Lisa Zwambila, to take a look at this and see what we make of it. Mona Lisa, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's perhaps start with the hard truth around financial inclusion, wealth creation, and the economic costs at the moment that are specifically confronted by women.
Okay, great. Well, firstly, thank you for having me. It's great to be on your show. I think, you know, women really do have several challenges when it, comes to finances. And what we know for sure, financial inclusion is very difficult to be had when gender inequality exists. And, you know, some stats that really are quite alarming is the fact that in South Africa, the gender pay gap is sitting between 23 and 35%, which is interestingly well above, you know, the ILO's average. And this is in a country where we have amazing policies for women, but we still have a situation where women are being paid less. And so, you know, when we obviously have the financial inclusion conversation, we do need to look at some of these issues. Another point to note, which is really an important one, is the fact that we know that 42% of households in South Africa are led by women. And so women have this additional burden of being caregivers, earning less. And the financial inclusion debate then says, how are women able to do that under these circumstances?
Mona, how are women able to do that? I mean, if we're looking at things around spending power, it's very clear as a result of conversations like inequality in pay, the gender pay gap drives a very clear message that women might not always have the same spending power as men, but they somehow still manage to make better decisions and more sustainable financial decisions. Where's the secret here?
Well, the truth is, I think it's a massive struggle for women generally. What we know from a marketing perspective is that most purchase decisions are made by women. Globally, it's sitting at around 70 to 80%. In South Africa, it's 65% of all purchase decisions are made by women. But it's a number like 80% of all, you know, supermarket purchases are made by women. So despite these, you know, financial challenges, we know that women are still doing the most in terms of spend because they are caregivers, they are, you know, mothers, etc. And so you find that women are actually the ones that are spending the little money they have, you know, to, and that obviously impacts the economy as well.
Mona, you just launched Femio. Now, for those that don't know about this particular initiative, this was launched just last week. It is squarely aimed at addressing some of these serious concerns and challenges that confront women around financial inclusion, around equality or inequality, as it would be at this stage, whether we're looking at the power of collective voices and collective collaborations. Tell us about what brought this particular initiative about, because this isn't the first business you've launched, but it is a very important business for where we find ourselves at the moment.
No, absolutely. I mean, Femio is definitely more than a passion project or a new business. It really is a business that's been built very much on my lived experience. Single mother, have done the struggle over the years in terms of how to make ends meet. And so the statistics that I shared earlier are very much personal, not only to me as a woman, but I'm sure to the many women that are listening to this conversation. And I really wanted to try and find a solution that would benefit women, not only through words and panel discussions and conversations, but something that would really benefit women and help them, you know, have more disposable income at the end of each month. Because ultimately, financial independence is one of the big things that women need, and it is one of their biggest aspirations. So Femio is really built on that premise, to find a way to, you know, actually ensure that we can drive gender equality, but do it really from a financial perspective. So what the app does, it's built on a simple premise that at scale, we have the numbers as women, and at scale, you know, women are able to negotiate for better pricing. You know, women collectively are able to have agency socially and collectively. And, you know, the way we are doing that is really just focusing on an insight that we know for sure. And that's really built around the fact that women generally, over and above the gender pay gap, women have a cost just by virtue of their biology. You know, women spend money on menstrual costs, reproductive costs, menopause, costs of safety. And this is almost like an additional tax that women have by virtue of their biology. And so Femio as an app, I'm encouraging women to download the app. What it does is it helps you calculate your monthly cost of being a woman, and then it works to give you that money back. And that is really the aspiration for Femio, is to literally put tangible money back into women's pockets and to be able to track how much money you're able to get back on the app. The way you do that is through partners. We've been aggressively, you know, looking to grow the partner network side of the app so that women are able to benefit from rewards, from savings, discounts that actually put money back in their pockets and really assist them with their daily lives.
Mona, when we look at the financial inclusion conversations and we look at the empowerment conversations, particularly as they relate to women and women entrepreneurs, I suppose, given that you come from that environment as well, how do we continue to advance that conversation beyond just a conversation? I mean, Femio is one such initiative, one such example of something that can be tangibly done to address some of the challenges that are out there. But what else do you feel needs to be done? You touched on conversations around government putting in place policies. Where else do you think work needs to be done to ensure that we achieve greater inclusion?
Look, I mean, one of the reasons, once again, I started Femio is because there are loads of policies. Implementation of policy is possibly an area that needs to be focused on. Last year, the World Economic Forum released research on gender equality globally. And what the research revealed is the fact that gender parity will only be reached in 123 years. And that's not even in my lifetime, our children's lifetime, or their children's lifetimes. And so I think what is clear is that the gender inclusion, the gender equality conversation has to go beyond policy. And also, I do believe that there are opportunities for private sector to also see how they can, contribute to ensuring that there is inclusion, there's, gender equality, and that we start to lessen the gender pay gap. But I do also believe there are some, areas that government should start looking at that actually impact, the amount of disposable income women have. For me, the fact that women and men, single mothers and, individuals are taxed exactly the same when a single mother might have more dependents, it for me is already something, that could be looked at. And various others, we could look at, pension and retirement, and how when women have to stay home to look after their children, how do we ensure that they're still able to have retirement, ensure that their retirement isn't impacted by the time they retire. So there's quite a few tangible areas that should be looked at beyond policy that will really sort of help to, change the equation when it comes to what women earn and how they survive day to day.
Mona, you mentioned policy and how it is that that could be a catalyst towards improving the inclusion conversations and the equality conversations we're having at the moment. What other bottlenecks are you seeing in the economic sense that continue to stand between women and achieving greater financial inclusion and perhaps greater wealth creation?
The policies are there. I think South Africa possibly has one of the most progressive policies for women globally. And that shows up in the number of women that we see in management positions, the number of women we see in parliament. We're really up there with the best in the world. What I think where the challenges sit really is from a social perspective. We know that nearly 26 million people are on social grants, the majority of them women who are all grandmothers that are raising, children. We know that there's a lot of cultural and structural issues that women also need to contend with that also impact their ability to earn, and the way it is great as we know, but it's also important that the implementation of those policies is really, done at sort of grassroots level as well.
Achieving greater inclusivity and improving the inequality gap that we find in South Africa requires collective effort as well as the ability to understand where some of our problems actually sit. We'll have to leave this conversation on that note. Serial entrepreneur and founder at Femio, Mona Lisa Zwambila, joining us to take a look at achieving greater inclusivity, particularly in entrepreneurship.
With a complete view of your finances, Nedbank Private brings every aspect of your financial life together to create solutions tailored to your evolving needs. From private banking and lending to long-term financial planning and wealth management, Nedbank Private supports you at every stage of your financial journey. While others see only part of you, we see all of you. See money differently. Nedbank Private. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
All throughout today, we have been reflecting on the essential components of empowerment, especially in the South African context and in empowering women to be part of the South African economy in the greatest sense. We're going to be wrapping up the conversation perhaps with one of the most inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and perseverance, especially in an industry that might not always be rewarding of such initiatives. We're going to be taking a look at the journey of the founder and CEO of SRS Aviation, Sibongile Sambosha, joins me on the line now to get a sense of what it is that allowed her to get to where she is today. Sibongile, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time.
You.
Quite the bold move to venture into the aviation industry. What brought that about for you?
Sure. Yeah, I've always been passionate about aeroplanes. My home is in Bushbuck Ridge, and I studied in KZN. Most of the time from high school and boarding school at Inanda Seminary. And my mother used to book me on a flight once a year from Nelspruit to Durban. That's how I got interest in aviation, in aeroplanes in general. So, yeah, later on then I started a business in what I was passionate about, and that is aviation.
I've certainly been to Bushbuck Ridge, and I know that to be inspired by aviation, especially when you look at some areas of the country, certainly is something. Spongile, how do you even approach the aviation industry as somebody that wants to build a business in that space? Was that always the idea from your perspective to build the kind of business you've built with SRS Aviation, or did that come from being in the industry and seeing where you could do something different?
No, not at all. I was not in aviation. I'm a human resources practitioner. That is my profession. And prior to me getting into the aviation industry, I've moved from different companies within human resources. So when we were encouraged post the 1994 elections to look at entrepreneurship as a career option, that's when I searched my soul for what lies within me that I'm passionate about. And it was aerospace, especially given that when I'm home in Bushbuck Ridge, I would see the aeroplanes flying in and out of Hoedspruit. Then that created the love for aeroplane, the curiosity around that. And when I applied to various airlines, including South African Airways, to become an air hostess at the time, now called cabin crew, I was declined because of my height. And that opened an opportunity for me to then really go hard on the opportunity within, aviation as an entrepreneur. So that's how I landed in that space as an entrepreneur. It was not something that I planned at all, but I just took advantage of a negative situation and turned it into a positive.
Spongile, as an entrepreneur, as a female entrepreneur in the aviation industry, you are potentially one of very few that have built a business in this space and built such a specialized business. What would you say have been some of the challenges that you found may have been unique to you, given your position in this industry?
There's been several challenges. One, I'm still being referred to as Mr. Sambo on emails because people, they assume that the other person on the other side of an email is a male because it's aviation. Secondly, when I started in aviation, I was very young. I was in my late 20s. So being young and black, venturing into this industry was very hard to penetrate and get in. I had to really work very hard and prove, that I am worthy to do business with within the industry. Getting access to finance has been another challenge. It's a capital-intensive business. Without experience in aviation and without any capital, it's been a challenge as well to just penetrate and move forward. But with all that, I've always, found a way to make things happen, because as a person, I do not give up easily. And once I set my mind into achieving something, I go for it. I make sure that I achieve the goals that I have set for myself.
If you're just joining us, we're in conversation with Spongile Sambo, the founder and CEO of SRS Aviation, a business focused on offering specialized aviation services in a market that is in desperate need of some of these specialized services. Spongile, I want to take a look at how you were able to persevere through some of the challenges that you mentioned. I want to get a sense of, from your perspective, what helped you navigate some of these difficult challenges? What helped you continue to remain motivated, and what ultimately led you to having your own hangar space at an airport?
Yeah, so take for instance our first flight that we needed to do. It was between Christmas and New Year in 2004. My family didn't know that I had left my permanent employment in October already. So I was home already for a few months and they didn't know. So when I got an opportunity to do my first flight for one of the biggest clients, I had to lease an aircraft that had to reposition from Dubai to South Africa. And it needed more than R1 million to position the aircraft or lease it, and another million to be able to fuel the aircraft so that it's able to do the flight. I had to then tell my mother, who had retired and working as a nurse in London, She flew back to come and release her pension money and give it to me for me to be able to start the business. So those are some of the examples. I can tell you lots and lots of stories that of things that I had to do to be able to achieve my goals, regardless of all the challenges and the barriers that were in front of me to get the business off the ground. And we've managed to have offices at an airport because of partnerships, strategic partnerships and collaboration. I had to learn very fast that in business, you cannot be an island. You need to work with people. So through those relationships, we managed to then secure space for us. And we've been there for many years at Lanseria Airport. Actually, since inception, we've been at Lanseria Airport. But we're able to service any airport within our borders, even outside of our borders. Lately, we do a lot of ground support services, even in Lesotho, and many other airports within South Africa. So, yes, we push to get into the opportunities.
Swangile, how do you take on new challenges? Surely in the aviation space, there might be one or two things that particularly perhaps at the start of your career, you didn't have the experience in, or that you were still building up experience in, given that your background is not in aviation. How did you push through the fear of not being sure whether or not you're able to deliver on these services?
One thing about me is that I take risks. And once I set my mind into achieving a particular goal, there's nothing that will really prohibit me or block me from achieving, those dreams. So one of the things that I do very well as well is that I've managed to learn the aviation industry. Even before I left my permanent employment, I would start marketing myself, as an aviation company. I would do painstaking research. When one gets into the boardrooms, you need to be able to speak the language that is spoken in the industry. You cannot just go blindfolded and say, because I'm passionate about aviation, therefore I should be able to make it. It is important to research. You need to understand the environment. You need to understand the people and what is required and what the clients want from you. So with me, I am able to read the room. I'm able to chase after the opportunities. I'm able to find, the funding that I need to service that particular transaction. So I take it by piecemeal. I don't go for a big funding requirement. I go for a funding requirement of a specific flight that I need to do at a particular time. So those are the things that have helped me to be able to stay focused and stay in business.
Spongile, what would you say is the best advice you could give to a female entrepreneur that might be looking at venturing into an industry they don't know, or perhaps venturing into a project that they might consider intimidating? You touched on the fact that you are naturally someone who enjoys taking that element of risk. What would you say to somebody who is uncertain about that but wants to try something anyway?
I would say to a female entrepreneur, if you have an idea or you have a dream to achieve a certain business, go for it. Don't listen to those small voices on the background. Focus and believe in yourself, number one. Then believe in the idea that you have. Then do your painstaking research on what is required for you to be able to achieve that, and go for it. So don't allow fear to block you from the opportunities or the ideas that you have. So, and that goes for males as well, but being a Women's Month, I would like for women to know that the ideas that we have, that we carry, it's possible to achieve them. And as women, we can multitask. We are gifted in many ways, and let's take advantage of the gifts that we naturally have to be able to do business.
It's often very, very easy to be intimidated by situations and allow them to get the better of you. But it is very clear and very evident that you, if you are able to push through, if you are able to persevere, if you are able to stick to your guns, that anything is possible, anything is achievable. We'll leave this conversation on that note. Thank you so much to the founder and CEO of SRS Aviation, Sibongile Sambo, for joining us to take a look at her story, her journey through entrepreneurship, and what it is that allowed her to make a success of it.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And that's the show for today, folks. If you've missed any of the conversations, they will be made available as podcasts. The SAFM news team is standing by with the latest round of evening news. From our side, it is business as usual from tomorrow. For now, good night.